read something real quick, and then we'll do a 3-minute meditation to get ourselves started. Today I will walk in the light of my consciousness. My consciousness will be illuminated. The sun shall no more go down, neither shall thy moon withdraw itself. For thy Lord shall be thine everlasting light, and the days of thy mourning shall be ended. Who uses well his light, reverting to its source so bright, will from his body ward all blight. There are so many illustrations in the sacred text of the world relating to the light. The spirit is thought of as being the essential light. People are spoken of as being the candles of the Lord. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness comprehend it not. That is the darkness. That is, the darkness has no power over light. Light will overcome darkness, but darkness cannot overcome light. When Isaiah said that the Lord shall be thy everlasting light, he meant that there is a light within us, the light of truth, of spirit, of God, that cannot set, cannot become obliterated, cannot be blown out. The candle of the Lord burns forever because its wick is sunk deep in the wellsprings of reality. That light, that spring, that substance to which Jesus referred when he told the woman at the well that if ever she drank from it, she would never thirst again. It is no wonder that the woman asked him to give her of this water, that she might no longer be compelled laboriously to draw from the fountain that can become depleted. Today I will walk in the light of my consciousness, and my consciousness will be illuminated. My thoughts will be guided, and my way guarded. For I know that in my light there is no darkness. In this divine light there are no shadows.
Thank you.
Jackie, will you please lead us in a set-aside prayer?
Spirit, we ask that you be with us here today and help us to set aside everything that we think we know, all of our preconceived notions about what this book looks like, what our experience might be today. Just help us to be open to a new experience, God, and we're grateful to be here.
Amen.
Thank you, Jackie. All right, so yesterday, big day, we wrapped up the first step. We hit the second step, third step. We went in, talked about the three different types of inventory in the fourth step, and we had a little, we shared a little bit of experience with the fifth step. You know, the reading this morning, part of the reason why I wanted to read it is because all three of the speakers yesterday but were fantastic, and you could see if you looked into their eyes, you could see something. There was something going on. There was a certain level of light, if you will. And because I was able to really, really focus in on Lindsay last night when I was sitting there watching her, I mean, just if you would look, if you were looking into her eyes, you could see there's something magical going on within the inside of her. There is an intensity. There is a peace. There is a presence about her. And that reading that I read before the meditation, if you could understand it through all my choppy reading, it was basically saying that once that light comes into you, nothing can touch you. And we've been working our way through the steps kind of slowly here, building that foundation for building up our immunity to ourselves, understanding what the darkness that is within us really is. And we get, if we've done well, if we've got a good sponsor, and we truly understand what the first step is about, and we truly understand that there, and Lindsay captured it so wonderfully last night, that there is no hope in the first step. The first step tells me I am absolutely going to drink again. If I look at my life, my default position is drinking. Every time. Every single time. And that the only thing that can save me from that is the rest of the steps. And that in the second step, I explore, what do I really believe that there's a power out there that can help me? In the third step, I turn my will and life over to this thing that I don't really know what it is. I don't even know what it means to turn over my will and my life. In fact, I think that the whole prayer is kind of funny because, you know, the creator of the universe who can do whatever it wants, we say a prayer to say, I'm going to, you know, turn my will and my life over to you, when the universe looks at you and goes, oh, isn't that cute? I could take your will away from you anytime I want. But yet, that's fine. We'll give you a prayer to let you think that you're doing something. So then that prayer is a commitment. The decision within that prayer is, I'm going to go through with the rest of the process. And so I go through and I write these three inventories. And then I share it with another person. And then that other person helps point out some things that I'm unaware of because I can't see what's going on behind me. Because all of my resentments are behind me. It's the wake of my life. Everything I've done forever, it's behind me. And I don't want to look back because I'm too busy like making sure I get mine ahead, right? I'm too focused on what I'm supposed to get out of life. So I can't see all that shit. So I need my sponsor or another accountability person to point out that the wake is huge. It's a no-wake zone, and you've been driving through this thing at 100 miles an hour, and you're wrecking everything on shore. Well, but I'm trying to get over there. And so we have to slow down long enough in the fifth step for that other person to give us some guidance. Now, on page 76, We have these two wonderful steps that occupy two paragraphs. That when most people are talking about the steps, they kind of just kind of glaze over these two steps. And I think they're, for me, they're two of the most magical steps that there are. Because it's the turning point of my life. It's the turning point of my life where I get to actually decide whether or not I want to live in a way that doesn't harm people, or if I want to just keep on wrecking shit the way that I've been doing it. And so in that first paragraph, the sixth step, on page 76, there's a question that has another question within it. It says, are we now ready to let God remove from us all these things which we have admitted are objectionable? Do I believe they're objectionable? Because if I don't see value in getting rid of these things, I am never going to ask God to take them away from me. Or I might ask for it, but I don't really mean it. And if my thoughts are prayers, and I say, God, please take these away from me, but I'm thinking in my head, I really want to keep these things, God's going to go, all right, well, you can keep them. So do I earnestly want to get rid of these things? And the only way that I become convinced that I need to get rid of those things is if I've done a thorough fourth and fifth step and the other person has pointed out to me, I'm going to go backwards in some of these. I keep a lot of the notes that people give me from when I read fifth steps. This last time in February when I went through envy, sloth, gluttony, expectation of what should be, lost touch with reality, delusion, self-dishonesty, respect equals money, success equals money, need to set expectations, entitlement, okay? So, wow, these should be new. I've never experienced these, right? I go back to another inventory. I'm the greatest. And then I was asked to contemplate, if we are all extensions of one another, God, then how am I the greatest? The status of greatness makes us less appreciated. Others' actions / recovery is a reflection of me. I want others to stay out of my life. What does faith look like? People must act the way I want them. This is from 3 years ago. People must act the way I want or think is appropriate. Sponsees held a higher standard than me. Not sensitive to how others affect me. Control issues. Sense of entitlement. This one's from 2 years ago. People's behaviors are reflective on me. I demand respect. My path is the best. Money equals security. Oh, wait, hold on a second. That's still here. So many of these are still here. I want to be someone in AA. I deserve this, that, the other. I don't trust the process. I cannot control. This is from one when I was 2 years sober. Demanding nature. Need to control. Idea that others' behaviors define me. Well, that showed up again. My validation comes from others' behavior. That showed up again. The idea that I always do my best. Oh, that's all over this stuff. I know what's best for others. Do I want what I have? Money equals value equals happiness. Laziness. Respecting authority. So, you know, I haven't done the exercise where I've gone back through and looked at these as a group, but it's clear that stuff that showed up in my second inventory is still here. I must see a value in it. I must be holding on to this. Now, if there's a lot of other notes on here that other people have given me, but if I'm really looking at these things, do I really want to be controlled by these principles, by these ideas, by these things? Do I really, really want to do that? Or do I really want to say, God, please take this away from me? Now, I can tell you that every time I've read that, I have wanted to get rid of this stuff. But there must be something within me that's still clinging to it, because a lot of that keeps showing up in my inventory again and again and again. Now, if you've lived the last 5 years with me, I am convinced you would tell me that the man I am today is so much greater than the man I used to be. But I still struggle with the same old things again and again and again. Imagine how much I would be struggling with them today if I actually wasn't continuing to work this. If I wasn't actually willing to continue to go deeper into this. And then we get to this seventh step prayer that again is one paragraph. And it's simply the completion of the third step prayer. There's no amen at the end of the third step prayer. There's an amen at the end of the seventh step prayer. I believe, there's a lot of theories behind it, but I believe that everything from the beginning of the third step prayer to the completion of the seventh step prayer is a continuous prayer. Is that I'm asking God to show me, show me, show me, show me, show me through the inventory process. I believe that if I say the prayer and legitimately say the third step prayer, and that I don't actually do the work in steps 4, 5, and 6, that God will continue to show me how I'm selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened. But it's going to come at me in real experience instead of on paper. And what I see for so many people is that as that comes at them, they can't deal with it and they go out again. Because they have opened Pandora's box to God and said, show me how I show up in relationships. And if I don't write, it's going to show up. You're going to experience it just in a different way.
Thanks, Brandon. If you're sitting in this room on Sunday morning, one of your greatest defects of character are the physical and mental symptoms of alcoholism and drug addiction, and those have been suppressed. But they can come back, right? If we don't treat our internal condition, it'll become so unbearable that you have to have relief from it, and the mind will eventually take you back to the source of relief, even though it's a delusion, the relief won't be there. And so the same applies with any of these defects. They can go into remission and they can come back. I want to read something out of Bill's story because he talks about defects of character so differently than he does in the two paragraphs on page 76. This is on page 13. Bill says, "There I humbly offered myself to God as I then understood him, to do with me as he would. I placed myself unreservedly under his care and direction. I admitted for the first time that of myself I was nothing, that without him I was lost. I ruthlessly faced my sins and became willing to have my newfound friend, God, take them away, root and branch." I've not had a drink since. I think the branch is the consequences that our defects create. The root is the underlying defect or aspect of character that's self-defeating. A lot of times, I want the consequences associated. I want to continue to eat like shit. I just don't want any of the consequences that are going to come to me later in life. All right, am I willing to eat better? Yeah. Am I entirely ready? Do I find it objectionable? No. That's a current defect for me. Right, and that's what I'm dealing with. I haven't asked this. These are off the cuff right now. This morning, I was reflecting as Brandon was talking. One of my defects right now is the fact that I have a belief that since I work so hard at my job, that I don't need to work as hard at home. That my wife should just do more. Right. I know this is a current defect for me. I noticed it last night when I was laying on the couch. When I got home after a hard day of carrying the message, I deserved for her just to do some more stuff than she typically does. I don't want to be like that. I do find that one objectionable. That is objectionable to me. But there's such a difference between willingness and being entirely ready. And you only become entirely ready when the defect is objectionable. But here's the illusion of value has to be snuffed out. This is the long and the short of it. As long as you're getting something from it, it ain't going away. And then there's this other concept that I've been working with. I stumbled across this video on YouTube of Carl Jung, and he worked with this concept that there were certain character and personality traits and attributes that were genetic. that you can't, that they'll always be with you. There are defects, there are aspects of my character that have been with me in every piece of work I've done. Why is that? It doesn't seem like they're going anywhere. They're blameworthy traits, and in some regards, they've become praiseworthy traits. They make me very useful to others. This is from 2 years ago. My need to be validated by others. Jealousy, superiority. The belief that anything going on inside of me is about something going on outside of me. The belief that I'm entitled and deserve the best. The belief that God owes me for all the work I've done. The belief that I should not have to work as hard as others. My personal need to advance my own plans and designs. And so then there's a list of 20 defects on here. And there were five that I was just not willing to find objectionable. The need to be important. The belief that I'm entitled and deserve the best. The belief that God owes me. The belief that I should not have to work as hard as others. And my need to advance my plans and designs. That those were the ones after I reflected. I was like, you know what? I don't know. I'm just not willing. I'm getting something from these things by operating in this way. So I wrote a 6-step prayer. God, please give me the willingness and strength to have these aspects of my character removed and done away with for good and all. And then I sat with it for about a week, and then I went into my 7-step prayer. God, please change me once again. Please remove anything that stands in my way of being useful to you. Please grant strength, willingness, and the capacity to help your children. Please refine my character so I may have deeper, more meaningful experiences with you. Please help me know my qualities and spirit are one with you. There is no God but God. Do I get resentful when my defects don't go away? I don't. They're there for a reason. I accept that. Let's look at this recent piece of work. I just read some of that 2 years ago. This was spiritual pride this year, need for approval. I don't trust my own heart, meaning I get intuitive thoughts and then I second guess them. I only have constant thought of others when they are like me. So when I'm similar to someone, I'll constantly put you first and think about you. But when you're different from me, I'm not quite as patient and tolerant and loving. Lack of surrender around work. No one else can have their own experience. It must be the experience I want for them. I don't actively listen at times. I'm impatient with my daughter. I always have to be right. I'm unwilling to try new things. I must be in control. I must be important in order to have a purpose. I know what's best for others. So this is from this most recent piece of work. And it forces me to have a new experience. It forces me to look at my character. And without these defects, I wouldn't sit back down at this table with God on a frequent basis. The defects are an extension of my unmanageability, and they block me from God. So when they're showing up like this, they're together with unmanageability. It's my lack of belief that God is present in that area of my life, and so I'm blocked. So I go back through the work, so I can be unblocked, so I can be a hollow bone, so I can be more effective with the men that I sponsor. The one thing I'd want you to take away from this piece of work here we're doing around step 6 and 7 is they will remain with you until the illusion of value is snuffed out. Whatever your defect is that you're struggling with, it's not going anywhere until you get nothing from it. And typically this happens, the defects are removed when they're causing the most pain they've ever caused. That's how they get removed. So, I think that's all I've got on 6 and 7.
A couple thoughts that kind of came in is, you know, there's a lot of things that we see as defects that are also assets. One of my defects is I like to be the center of attention. Exhibit A.
I
God will use some of these defects to the benefit of others. Now, when how that defect shows up in a different way is when somebody's having a conversation, I sometimes want to just go jump in and like join the conversation because I want to be the center of attention, right? I'm being left out. Well, that's rude. So through continual work in the steps and the 10th step is I get to see those things as I'm like kind of edging up to a conversation. I'll say to myself, hang back and wait for a break in the conversation before you enter. For years, I've been having to shave every day since eighth grade. Every day. Not just like kind of like eighth grade, I would shave in the morning and still get the 5 o'clock shadow. For years, I've struggled with the fact that I've had to shave every day until finally I get out of the relationship where the wife thinks that the beard is absolutely disgusting. Grow a beard. And the craziest thing is that although the woman I was married to before found the beard disgusting, the woman I'm married to now says, if you ever shave your beard, I'm leaving you. How does that happen? One person, it's a defect. Another person, it's an asset. And these are how all of our personality traits show up. The difference is, is it showing up for good or is it showing up for bad? If a person is one that likes to sensationalize and do all this stuff, they are generally great storytellers and really, really fun until they're telling a story about you and they're exaggerating it. And then they are just terrible people. Because I used to be in a relationship with a woman like that where she was great when she was talking about other people because it was funny. But when she's telling a story about me and it's like, that is not the way that that happened. But it makes me look worse, makes me sound funnier, makes me sound stupider, whatever it is. And so that's kind of how the defects on both sides. But we don't say the seventh step prayer and then those ones that we really want to go away, they don't just magically poof and go away. The way that they go away is, like Tarek said, when it's finally causing us enough pain. And a lot of the time that happens as we go out and make those amends. If I make enough amends to people over and over and over again for being an asshole, at some point in time, it comes into my consciousness that I'm an asshole. And I don't want to be that way anymore. So I start to change. That's why steps 8 and 9 are so vital. Now, I wanted to say at the beginning, and I forgot. So in early recovery, I was at things like this every chance I could get. I wanted to learn more. I wanted to go deeper. I wanted to know the most that there was about this thing that seemed magical to me, both the steps and God. And there's a lot of you that are required to be here, but there's a lot of you that have been showing up every single session and digging in. And if you're early in recovery and you're showing up every session and digging in, I like your chances. I like the fact that you're hungry for this thing, because I can tell you it's real easy to get excited at certain points, like when shit's really bad and I need to do this. It's harder to get here and do this thing when there's nothing really wrong. But when you dive in and you keep doing it and you go deeper and deeper and deeper, that period of when nothing's wrong extends and it gets greater. So for those of you who we've seen you consistently here, thank you. Because it gives me hope that somebody actually is going to leave this thing with some new perspective, actually leave this thing excited about what's going on. And so those of you I'm speaking to, you know who you are. So thank you. And then I screwed up the segue into the eighth step. So
No. You did fine. I want to interject real quick. About 2 years ago, as part of my third step, I was given the instruction to pray. And once three people were revealed to me, I needed to go to them and ask them what does it look like when I live a life that doesn't have consideration for other people and I just do what I want, you know, nose to the grindstone, straight ahead. I try not to ask them what my life looks like run on self-will because they usually have no idea what the hell I'm talking about. So I try to put it in layman's terms. And so I went to my boss, my VP at my old company, and I'll never forget this. We're sitting at Starbucks, and he said, "Tarek, it's painful for me to watch you try to change yourself." He says, "You continually are trying to change things about your character. You're the way God made you. Be okay with it." That's what he said to me. And this is nowhere in our big book does it say that you're going to remove your defects of character or that I'm going to remove my defects of character. It's just not going to happen. Because what happens when you use that intent as you work these steps is you're going to set the bar here for how you want to show up without these defects or very limited defects, and you're going to show up here. And constantly trying to close that gap is going to leave you in a state of internal violence with yourself. And you can't be present. You can't see the world in totality. You will see it through a skewed filter because you're constantly trying to close that gap. And so that's one thing I want you to take from here is, go ahead.
I have a lot of kind of spiritual stuff, but when I think about defects as I get further down the road, it's like things like smoking or like eating. You know, like, I'm never going to not see the benefit of how I like smoking or choosing Taco Bell breakfast over something healthy. And I want to, like, put that on, you know, if it takes a maximum amount of pain to change, then smoking, you know, eventually that happens. And I don't want to progress to that point. And I desperately want to stop certain unhealthy factors that are more physical than spiritual. What is your experience around those things? I don't know. I'm getting pretty pissed off.
So there's the make it obvious prayer, right? Which I don't like using this one because it's like it is complete abandon to faith that God's going to help you, right? So the example I like to give is. So if I've got a dog that's sick and it's a choice between doing a $1,500 treatment that may not work or putting the dog to sleep, and I can't decide, then I'll go to God and say, "God, please make it obvious whether or not I'm supposed to do this $1,500 treatment for my dog." Now, you say that prayer, you may not like the answer. You may not like what comes back because the answer will come back obvious, but it may come back obvious from the standpoint of my dog gets run over by a car. Guess I'm not supposed to spend the $1,500. The answer was obvious. So where do you want to take your faith? You can go to say, "God, I want to be healthier. Please make it obvious how to do that." And you may say, "I want to lose 20 pounds. I may get a sickness that makes me lose 40 that lasts for a year. But I lost the 20 pounds. After I get well after that year, maybe the 20 pounds stays away." So it's one of those things where how far do you want to go? Now, what I've been doing is I have been praying because I'm not pleased. My pants keep getting tighter. It's the strangest thing. And so I have said to God, "God, please help me find a healthy way to live that motivates me to want to do better." And so a strange set of circumstances show up where there's a special at a gym and I join the gym and I, "God, please make," so okay, and we've gone that far. "God, please motivate me to get to the gym." And so my life organizes in such a way. So it's some you can go for the drastic or you can just kind of go for the little bit, "God, please show me a way to make smoking seem unattractive to me." And then it starts to work. So because there's not really an amend that's going to force you into that position. And the physical stuff is hard because, well, I think that we see value in it, but we don't see value in it. So, I mean,
I'm going to use my personal experience. This is the lack of power that we live, as limited as we are. I've had 5 surgeries in the past year. You think that's directly related to my diet, perhaps? These are all health issues I've had. I've had a kidney stone on top of the 5 surgeries, and I still smoke. I still vape. I still don't eat very healthy on a consistent basis, and I'm okay with it. It's one thing when I'm smoking and I'm constantly beating myself up. I gotta quit. I gotta quit. I gotta quit. There's not much of that judgment there. It comes in from time to time. What are you gonna do? I'm gonna fight the way God is existing through me. If I really truly believe the second step proposition and God is everything, or am I gonna pick and choose what God is and what God isn't? That's the way I look at it. We're going to roll into step 8. Those of us that have been influenced by certain people like Mark H. and Joe H. and Chris R. and Don P., we've been introduced to this idea of a note card system. So newcomers are so afraid of step 9. They see those amends. And the voice says, you're never going to make these amends. You should just quit now while you're ahead. Right? That's what the voice says. So these guys came up with a system that it's incredible. So you make your list of people that you have harmed and people that you owe money to and institutions that you owe money to. And you ask yourself, Joe, okay, am I willing to make this amends? Yes. Do I know where he is and do I know how to track him down? Yes. So plus plus. I label that note card plus plus. On the front of the card, I put his name, his contact information, and I put the nature of the harms. Just words to remind me. I don't get super descriptive on my note cards. I need one word that's going to remind me of the nature of my harm.
Oh, my.
Yes. And then I get to Sarah, and I'm not willing to make my amends to Sarah, but I know where she is. So I put minus plus. All right, she's in another pile. All right, then I get to Marcy, and I'm willing to make the amends, but I have no idea where to find her. It's going to take some effort. So I put plus minus. Same thing, name, whatever information I have, nature of the harm. And then Zach, you know, hadn't seen him in 25 years. Don't really care if I see the motherfucker ever again. I'm not really willing to make this amends. Minus. Plus, but I know where he is. Or minus, minus if I have no idea. So now I've got 4 piles, right? Plus, 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 minus, minus, plus, minus, minus. I put all the cards in their piles, and I put all the piles away. I only work on plus, plus, and it's usually the largest stack. And it's usually going to take you, I'm willing to bet, the better part of your first year in recovery to make all those amends, if not longer. The big book says there's a long period of reconstruction ahead. Earlier this year, I made my last approach on number 230. I had 230 amends when I got clean and sober. I haven't completed all those amends, but I've approached all of them. All I have left now is financial amends that I'm still paying on. And I added this up last week. After this year, I will have paid back in excess of $12,000 in 9 years. And I've still got another $20,000 in amends I have to make, financial amends. I'm always in the action of making amends. So 9 times 12, what is that, 108? Yeah, 108 months that I've been clean and sober. I have probably sent money out into the universe in the form of a financial amends at least 65 to 75 of those 108 months. I'm always in the action of sending something back into the universe. And it can be anywhere from 25 to up to as much as $400 in a month. I am convinced that all of the success I have had, I have always had more money than I need my entire recovery. I've had wonderful opportunities come into my life as a result of making these amends. That's the connection with it all. But you got to start somewhere. You got to start with the process. The note card system is perfect. I'm okay when guys I sponsor say I'm not willing to make that amends. I'm like, sweet, it goes in that pile. Because I know if they make all the plus pluses and then they make the plus minuses and they sit down, and I've got 3 wonderful websites that you can use: Zabasearch, Spokeo, S-P-O-K-E-O, you can it helps you track people down immensely. And then Facebook is a wonderful tool to send an approach letter. You don't make the amends over Facebook. You send the approach letter because you can see if they've read it. You send somebody a couple of approach letters, they don't want to talk to you. You can see it. You don't make the amends, but you say, look, I'm trying to straighten out my life. And I've been going back through my past, and it's clear to me that I've harmed you, and I am willing to make this right with you. If you ever want to sit down and talk, please contact me. Here's my phone number. Here's my email address. Done. I have become willing to make that amends. That is the eighth step. Okay? So, in our big book on page 76, they start going through these amends. We're not going to read all of this, but what I am going to, I want to highlight to you is like the types of amends that the book talks about. So on the bottom of 76, they start by talking about business acquaintances. Okay? They give you a bunch of wonderful rules to follow. At the bottom, top of 77, the purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us.
So it's a selfish program?
Yeah.
Read that again.
The purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. Doesn't sound selfish to me, does it? No. Oh, at the bottom of 77, simply we tell them that we will never get over our drinking until we've done our utmost to straighten out our past. I don't do that anymore. My sponsor, Scott, this was several years ago, we were having a conversation and, you know, he instructed me to begin working with this idea that I'm showing up to make these amends and I don't want to connect it to my addiction and my alcoholism. I don't want to use addiction and alcoholism as an excuse for what I did. Now, I know sometimes the harms I'm cleaning up have to do with things I did while I was on a spree, but I guarantee you, of those 230, I think more of them I did sober. It had nothing to do with my addiction. Right? So I don't know if your experience plays out like that or not. Top of 78, it talks about the person that we hate or the enemy. The middle paragraph on 78 is people we owe money, so creditors. The bottom paragraph on 78 starts talking about criminal offenses. The top of 79 is about alimony. The middle of 79 is when they start talking about when other people are involved. If you make this amends, you may harm them. That you may have committed a robbery with three people, and you can't really go make amends and say, I did it with these three people, right? You have to confer with them. That continues on the top of 88, or 80. Bottom of 80 is cheating on a spouse, being unfaithful. And then, of course, our favorite part of the book, right? We think we get clean and sober and all is well. Bottom of page 82. The addict and the alcoholic are like tornadoes roaring through the lives of others. Hearts are broken. Sweet relationships are dead. Affections have been uprooted. Notice they don't say alcohol and drugs have kept the home in turmoil. Selfishness and inconsiderate habits have. The feeling a man is unthinking when he says sobriety or being clean is enough. He's like the farmer who comes out of the cyclone cellar to find his home ruined. To his wife, he remarks, don't see anything of matter here, Ma. Ain't it grand the wind stopped blowing? And this is the top of 83 where it talks about a long period of reconstruction is ahead. A remorseful mumbling that we are sorry will not fit the bill. And then one of my favorite lines in our big book, the spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. And then the next paragraph is when we write a letter when we can't see somebody. So, you know, I wrote a bunch of letters years ago and I read them to a few people and it was very beneficial for me because I didn't have last names, had no idea how to track these women down in some cases. And, I sought out another female in the program and I read some letters to her and that was the method that was suggested to me. So I followed it. Brandon hit on it earlier. There are certain defects. Like one of my defects was not being where I was supposed to be when I first got clean. MIA. That was removed from me early on in recovery. I've always shown up and I'm typically, most of the time, I'm where when I say I'm going to be somewhere, I'm going to be there. But there are other defects that linger. And yes, I've made amends directly related to those actions, and it seems like they just hang out for some reason. But I still believe what Brandon says, that when you look into the eyes of someone, when you're making an amends and you really see how the selfishness and your selfishness and self-centeredness affects other people, there is a significant amount of power in the removal process of the defects. So my wife, I've treated her better than any woman I've been in a relationship with. How do I say this?
You're not a good boyfriend.
Yeah. I was never a good partner. How about that? I was never a good partner in all my past relationships. And then in early recovery, I was a male whore. And I used women just as an ends to a means. And I ended up having to make a lot of amends in recovery to females. A lot. The worst being this girl that had a few weeks, and I told her sponsor wasn't taking her through the book fast enough, and so I'll take you through the book. And anyway, we ended up having sex, and she relapsed shortly thereafter. And I was sitting in a meeting at the clubhouse, and this is when I was on fire, and I was in my Joe and Charlie phase, and I was preaching the big book. And I shared at this meeting, and it was a big meeting, and her sponsor got up in the middle of this meeting and walked over to me and said, "You're so fucking full of shit," in front of everybody. It crushed me. And then my sponsor said I couldn't walk away from that meeting. And he's like, you got to keep going to that meeting.
That's your punishment.
Yes. And I did make amends to the girl. I've never been able to find the sponsor, though. I never was able to find the sponsor. Her name was Tara, and she had a lazy eye, and she used to hang out Triangle, and I've just never been able to find her. I use that in case somebody in here knows her, because I'm willing to make that amends. But it didn't come up till after I moved on from that sponsor, and I went back through the steps where I realized I owed her an amends. But Kristen I made amends to, but that experience, along with several others in early recovery, I think removed a lot of those character qualities or attributes where my wife doesn't get the brunt of that. She just doesn't. So we're going to start sharing amends stories.
Yeah, I want to hit on a couple things real quick. We hear in meetings a lot, whenever we're talking about amends. There's this concept that people share about called living amends. Which is actually practicing the principles in all our affairs, but we'll go there later. But so the short form of the eighth step is real clear. It says, made a list of all. Does anybody know what all means?
It means all.
Oh, okay. I looked it up in a 1935 dictionary, and it means the same thing. So, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Ninth step says, made direct amends. Okay? So people will say, they harm me more than I harm them, so I'm just making a living amends with my current wife, and that's how I'm making up for it. Why is that direct? It's not. Certain sentences in here. Under no certain condition do we criticize such a person or argue. Okay. People will say, "Well, I don't have to make that one because it's going to harm my family or somebody else." Although these reparations take innumerable forms, there are some general principles which we find guiding. Reminding ourselves we have decided to go to any lengths to find a spiritual experience, we ask that we be given the strength and direction to do the right thing, no matter what the personal consequences may be. We may lose position or reputation or face jail, but we are willing. We have to. We must not shrink at anything. He saw that he had to place the outcome in God's hands or he would soon start drinking again anyhow. We must take the lead. I hear so many people say that, "Well, I'll make that amend when they show up." We must take the lead. We can't just wait for them to show up. And then there's people will, I love how people will like grab, pick and choose like certain sentences, but use them out of context. And one of the ones that is it's this paragraph, it says that there may be some wrongs we can never fully make right. On page 83 at the bottom, it says, and there may be a valid reason for postponement in some cases, but we don't delay if it can be avoided. We should be sensible, tactful, considerate, and humble without being servile or scraping. These are about the amends, okay? As God's people, we stand on our feet. We don't crawl before anyone. People will say, I don't have to make that amends because the book says I don't crawl before anyone. No, no, no. That's not what it means. What it means is I don't go to somebody to make amends and be like, I'm so sorry. No. You go to them as a person and say, look, what I did to you was wrong. Stand on your own feet. You don't slouch. You don't, like, go in with the knowledge that you know that you harm them. You don't crawl before them. You go as if you're an equal. And people get that stuff all confused all the time. And I think it's real important to talk about that because we hear so many strange things in meetings that don't come from the book. And that's just a couple of them as it relates to this. So, story first for me.
I'm gonna share quickly three amends stories. How about that? I could sit here for the next 4 or 5 hours and tell you amends stories, but I'm going to tell you three of my favorites. I slept with my best friend's fiance, and I shattered a whole group of friends. I mean, we would travel around this country. There was like a pack of us, about 15, 20 of us. Go to panic shows all the time. And we were at the core center of this group, and I slept with my best friend's fiance. And the group was forced to take sides. I was forcing people in the group to take sides, and I was trying to steal her from him. After I got clean and sober, I saw that I had to go back. So I had to go back and make amends to all the people in that circle of friends because I robbed all of them of the security of having that circle of friends. It really jacked things up for a long time. And I remember thinking that to myself, how does a best friend forgive a best friend for something like that? I'll never forget, we went out to lunch. And I it was clear the harm I had caused, and I told him I was willing to do whatever I needed to make it right. And we began talking about how it made him feel, and he unleashed on me, and the tears were coming, and I just listened. I listened. It was one of the most difficult amends I've ever had to make. And about 2 years later, he and I slowly began to start going to concerts together, and we slowly began to rebuild our relationship, and I made amends to her as well. And I was going out to the monastery for Mike D's workshop in 2010, and prior to the workshop, Mike D asks everybody to bring something that means something to you, has great value, an artifact or something, and you're going to lay it up on this front. On the front table at the monastery, and the very first night of the monastery, everyone that brought it something that meant a great deal to them had to go in front of the group and share with the group why they brought this artifact. That artifact was a really cool rock that had been wrapped as a pendant, given to me by my best friend. That's the power behind making amends. So when I got up in front of that group Friday night, that's the story I told. This process can heal anything. And healed a tremendously deep wound for my friend for what I did to him. Because we were boys. Boys don't do that to each other. That was, his belief system. And it was one of those things that proved to me after reading these pages that no further authentication was necessary. Because it was one of those things that just grounds you deeper into understanding and knowing how this process works, and it will always work. Another amends. So I walked in on my ex-girlfriend. This was in 2000. I caught her in the act of cheating on me. I got really violent. I pushed her. I pushed him. I had stalked her all night. I'd parked outside this. I had a feeling she was cheating on me with the bartender at a restaurant, and I was right. And And so I stalked her all night, and I saw her come out of his apartment, and I ran, busted the door in, caught her. And after I got clean and sober, he was on my, I'm never willing to make that amends, because I proceeded to assassinate his character, and I was talking shit to him about, to all his friends and what he had done, and I was just trying to slander him everywhere. And I'll never forget this. I must have been 3-4 years maybe. It was after I'd started working with Scott. I'm driving in that part of town, and I hear he still works at that bar. And the voice says, you need to pull into the bar and make this amends. I'm like, fuck, I ain't going to turn it into this bar. And the voice says, you're going to go to the bar and make this amends. And I'm driving down North Decatur Road, and the bar has two entrances, right? One on North Decatur and one that's sort of like at the very end before you turn on Scott Boulevard. And the second one, I said, fuck it. And I pulled in to the middle of the day at a bar, right? A bar slash restaurant. And so I walk in, and you know what the voice says to you, like, well, if he's not working, then it's not meant to be. Well, I walk in the middle of the day, and he's behind the bar. So I walk up to him, and I say, hey, Tony, what's up, man? Can I get a few minutes? And we sit down in one of the booths. And I started to make amends to the man who I walked in and caught cheating on with my ex-girlfriend. And as we were there, he started crying, and he asked for my forgiveness, and he made amends to me. And I took you, remember? This was like end of last year, Matt and I went to have lunch at this restaurant, and that guy was working. And I told Matt the story, and Matt made a comment along the lines of, I would have thought you guys had been boys forever, right? Because there was no sense of separation. That's as a result of the amends process. And the last one before I turn it over to Brandon. This one is to illustrate the ripple effects of our actions. So remember the group of friends I said that I hurt? One of the couples in that group I made amends to one night. And we used to use their apartment. When they would go out of town, the fiance that I was sleeping with would house sit at their apartment, and we would meet there and have sex because nobody would ever catch us there. And so I'm making amends to this couple for using their apartment in that way and robbing them of emotional security and forcing them to take sides. And we're sitting there at dinner, and they finally knew where the used condom had come from. All right, check this out. So that happened in 2003. I made this amends in 2008. For 5 years, this couple thought the other person had cheated. They didn't know where the condom had come from. Both of them were like, I don't know where that came from. So there was this thing of, we don't know what the hell's going on, and there's no closure. So they had to work through that. So for 5 years, they didn't know until that night I made amends. They finally got closure. What would have happened if I'd never become willing to make that amends? That's not even why I went to make, I had no idea we had left a used condom in their apartment. They got free. They got free that night because I became willing to make all my amends. And those are the three stories I've got for you. I've got many others that, make the hair on my arm stand up like it is right now. So this is an amazing process, but you have to engage it. I'm convinced when people relapse, they have unfinished amends every single time. Every single time. And it's one reason. You don't think making amends has anything with shooting dope in your arm. That's it. That's why people stop making amends. They lose connection.
They're playing God.
Go ahead.
Instead of trusting God. Which I've been thinking, there's two that have come into my consciousness that I need to share, but there's so many other ones that it's like, guys, this is so cool, I want to tell you about them. But so in this book by Emmett Fox, it breaks down the Sermon on the Mount. It also breaks down the Lord's Prayer, and it breaks down the Lord's Prayer by sentence. And the sentence, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive them that trespass against us. It breaks that down. It's like, so is there spiritual good? And like, do I just get a good feeling out of amends, or is there spiritual good that comes out of it? And I'm going to read a couple things real quick. The forgiveness of sins is a central problem of life. Sin is a sense of separation from God and is the major tragedy of the human experience. It is, of course, rooted in selfishness. It is essentially an attempt to gain some supposed good to which we are not entitled to in justice. It is a sense of isolated, self-regarding, personal existence, whereas the truth of being is that all is one. We try to live apart from God. We act as though we had a life of our own, as separate minds, as though we could have plans and purposes and interests separate from His. All this, if it were true, would mean that the existence is not one and harmonious, but a chaos of competition and strife. Well, many of us believe that. You must forgive everyone who has ever hurt you if you want to be forgiven yourself. That is the long and the short of it. You have to get rid of all resentments and condemnation of others, and not least of self-condemnation and remorse. You have to forgive yourself, but you cannot forgive yourself sincerely until you have forgiven others first. There are few people in the world who have not, at some time or other, been hurt, really hurt by someone else, or been disappointed or injured or deceived or misled. Such things sink into the memory, where they usually cause inflamed and festering wounds, and there is only one remedy. They have to be plucked out and thrown away. And the one and only way to do this is by forgiveness. If your prayers are not being answered, search your consciousness and see if there is not someone who you have yet to forgive. And so we don't think that by me going and making an amend to someone is actually me getting forgiveness of myself. But it is. And here, I'll give you an example of that. I worked for this guy for 7 years. He was my boss. He trained me. He cultivated me. He groomed me to be the best project manager I could possibly be. Problem is my alcoholism was kind of taking a hold of me. Had no idea, because this was so long ago. Alcoholism was taking a hold of me, and I would just not do shit around there. And then, like, after I didn't do it, then it would be like it was so overdue that it was like, well, I don't want to do it now, because if I give it to him now, then it'll be like really overdue, and then he'll see that I'm behind. So instead, I'll lose it and act like I never got it. And then when he comes and asks me about it, then I'll be like, well, I never got it. And so I would lose stuff constantly, and we would have clients that would call because they wanted to know where their stuff was, and I'd be like, well, I never got it. And so the clients would then call him, and they're like, well, we've only sent it to him 5 times. And so he would get frustrated with me, and he would talk to me in a way that I didn't appreciate, right? So I had a huge resentment against him. Resolved all that in the fourth and fifth step, but I wasn't willing to make the amends because this guy was an asshole. Because he yelled at me for not doing my job, right? And so I'm sitting in my office a couple years ago, and this guy comes in, and it's a subcontractor, and he's going to go see. He's like, oh, yeah, I thought I'd stop by because I'm going over to see this guy. And he says the guy's name out loud, and I just feel this, like, I hate that guy. And so the universe over the next week or so kind of had me ask myself a couple times, like, I was in the middle of doing certain types of things, and, well, why do I always do it this way? And it's like, well, it's because Bill showed you how to do it that way. It's like, oh. And it was a series of about a week where all these things, I realized that I had learned so much from this guy. So it was like, okay, I need to finally make this amend with this guy. So I call him, we go to lunch, we sit down, I make amends to him, no hard feelings. I basically forgive him because I realize that he took my career to the place where it is today. And about a week or a month later, this guy comes in the office and he says, hey, I'm going over to go see this guy again. And instead of that, I feel, oh, wonder how he's doing. Well, I didn't really follow up with him or anything, but through a set of circumstances, a week ago, I'm in a meeting with my old boss. And it was so neat because I could be in a meeting with him and know how he is and know his intricacies and cut up with him as if like nothing had ever happened. And this is a guy that I hated for like 8 or 10 years. And I'm sitting there appreciating him as a person and asking about genuinely how he's doing. And he's asking me, and he wants to know what's going on in my life. And it's because I made that amend that I didn't intend to make the amend to get something out of it, but I did. It repaired a relationship and let me see the relationship for what it really was. So a lot of the time we get real distorted in the way that we approach things, and we don't really understand why we do what we do, or why we act the way that we do. And then I want to share this one because it shows how to make an approach to somebody that is unwilling to see you. It also, I can show you how it kind of ties in with the 10th and the 11th step. So this guy tried to buy a house from me years and years ago. Let's see, if I back up 2 years minus 7. Anyway, so 9 years ago, he tried to buy a house from me. And I, it was when I was going through a financial collapse, and he gave me some earnest money, and I refused to give it back, even though he was entitled to it. And then he sued me, and I didn't even show up for court because it was just like, what's the point? Like, he's not ever getting his money. I'm never giving it to him. Fuck him. He screwed me. I saw him as the personification of the reason that my company failed, which isn't true. It failed because I would go to the strip club every day instead of actually working. But, you know, whatever. So I'm trying to buy a property 2 years ago, and I've got this judgment on my credit. And I can't buy this property until the judgment's removed. So I've got this extra motivation to find this dude. And so I can promise you I've been looking for him for a long time. To no avail. Emails, doing all this stuff. And so I'm sitting down with my buddy James, and we're going through the 8th and the 9th step, and we're talking about I think it was this paragraph, the sentence, under no condition do we criticize such a person or argue. And I'm like, you know, even if you think that you have justifiable reason for hating this person, and I'm like, you know, like, for example, I've got this guy, I used this whole example, this guy that I owe money to, that's going to keep me from buying my house because the universe is a funny way of kind of making sure karmatically everything evens out. And I said to him, you know, I've been looking for him, and I don't know how I'm going to find him. And so James says, well, what's his name? I'll look him up. And so I tell James the guy's name, but like what I really tell James is this is the guy's name, and in my head I think, fuck you, James, you're never going to find him. I've been looking for this guy for 2 years. And after I tell James the name, I said, you know what? What I haven't done is I haven't prayed to find this guy. So mocking prayer like I do. Hey, God, will you please help me find this guy? All right, there. Now I said the prayer, James. Whatever. And James is like, okay. You know, and he like pulls up a guy. He's like, is this him? I'm like, no, that's not him. And he keeps going. I was like, he was a mortgage broker, and that's about all I know. And James pulls, he says, is this him? Looking at it, I'm like, it looks like him. I hand it back to James. And says, oh, yeah, he was a mortgage broker. 5 minutes. I say a prayer. In less than 5 minutes, the guy shows up. So, I sit Carrie on trying to find this guy because we find out that he's working for the Department of Veterans Affairs out in Denver. And so a bunch of dead ends, dead ends, dead ends, dead ends. Eventually, she finds an email address for him. So I sent him an email. He doesn't reply to the email that I sent him, but he replies to an email that I sent him in 2013. Sent him an email on May 28, 2013. He replies on March 3rd, 2015, almost 2 years later. And the email that I sent him was like, hey, I owe you money. I need to make it right. He replies with no worries. I recouped about $300 through small claims court. I'm in Tulsa, Oklahoma at this point in time. This guy's in Denver, Colorado. Okay, I'll tell you how the 10th and the 11th step come in a second. I sent him an email back. I would like to settle the balance of the matter if you would be so kind. I have harmed you and need to do my utmost to straighten out this matter and make you whole. I have spent the last 2 years trying to track you down and only found you through prayer and assistance of several people. Please let me know if you would be so inclined. He replies with, if I had purchased your home, I would not be where I am today. That's how God works. If it is not to be, if God does not will it to be, I forgive you, God forgives you, and will bless you if you ask. He blessed me, so forget it and move on with your life. I certainly have. And then I said, hey, cool, he's down with God. So sounds like our mutual philosophies are the same. Would you care to have him coffee in the morning? He's in Denver, I'm in Tulsa, okay? So it's 5 o'clock-ish. I'm done with my work in Tulsa, and my intuition, the loud voice, says, drive to Denver and meet him. But then the quiet voice says, call Tarek and run this by him. And it's like, no. I'm going to do this. Like self-will, right? I'm driving overnight to have coffee. So I called Tarek. And I said, okay, so I found this guy. He's in Denver. I'm in Tulsa. I tell him a bunch of the background. And Tarek just laughs. And he goes, I love you. He loves the fact that I'm willing to actually do this. And he's like, the guy doesn't want to see you. he's like, just kind of let it go and, reach out to him and try to make it right. And I'm like, well, Tarek, there's more to this. Is that, you see, this house we're trying to buy, we can't buy if I don't get him to take this judgment off my credit. And Tarek's like, well, did you tell him that? I'm like, no, whenever I give a long explanation to an answer, it's usually because the answer's no. So Tarek's like, send him another email and explain to him clearly what it is that you intend to do. And so I send him this email. Please allow me to expand on my request to meet with you. I have been seeking to find you for several years. In the past, it was an attempt to make a direct amends to you, to pay you for the money I stole from you, and to remove the judgment you have against me on my credit report. The $1,000 you gave me as earnest money is still in the escrow account of this attorney. You indicated in your previous email that you were paid $900. However, I am unsure how this is possible as I did not pay you. The $1,000 is in the escrow account and is yours and will be in the account until the funds are released as a result of the satisfaction of the judgment. I do not believe my journey in trying to find you is simply to pay you your money. It may be, but it is my experience that a journey such as I have been on has a deeper and much more spiritual purpose. I must disclose to you that I earnestly want to meet with you for two reasons. The first and more self-serving reason is that my family and I intend to purchase a home in the next 45 days. Until the judgment you have against me is satisfied, I will be unable to purchase this home. The irony is not lost on me. The second reason is I would like to sit across from you and better understand how the harm I have caused you made you feel, to see if I have left anything out, and ask you how I can make this right with you. The forgiveness you offered in your previous email is appreciated. If you have reconciled this matter and wish to have no further contact with me, I understand and will respect your wishes. Independent of your wishes to have further contact with me, please contact this attorney, I give him his number, to complete the necessary paperwork to recover the money I stole from you. If you choose not to contact the attorney and complete the necessary paperwork, I understand your desire to not assist me, as I in no way had concern for you and your family when you called upon me to assist you. I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. As part of the spiritual journey in my recovery, it is imperative I constantly seek to further and deepen my relationship with God. It is also my personal belief that the best way for me to better seek and experience God is through analyzing my conduct and my interactions with all of God's children. Through the spiritual journey, I face my resentments, fears, and conduct towards others, and see how my selfish, dishonest, self-centered, and fearful behaviors dominate my life and lessen my ability to experience God and His children. A part of this process is to make direct amends to people I have impacted as a result of my behavior. You are one of these individuals. I do not make this approach with the disillusion that I am a good guy or that I ever have been. Today I seek God with the hope that through the consciousness of that experience, I may become a better husband, father, friend, worker, and member of society. Perhaps our paths will cross as we trudge the road to happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Crickets. Didn't hear from the guy. Oh. But that was great. I mean, eloquent and everything, right? Still trying to manipulate, even in my amends. But I call the attorney a week later, and I was like, "Hey, have you heard from this dude?" And he's like, "Yeah, I'm going to send him the paperwork." But he said, "You know, he did get some money back when he got the judgment against you. I released some of the money out of escrow. I didn't realize I did." And he said, "What do you want to do?" And I said, "Well, I own the interest, and I own the balance of the money." And I'm like, "And clearly I owe you some money for, you know, having to prepare the paperwork back then and actually preparing the paperwork now. So if you would figure out what that amount is, I will send you a check." Actually, I took him a check that day. I owed another, like, $300-$400 to the guy that I owed the amend to, and I owed the attorney, like, $350 or something like that. The judgment was satisfied and got cleaned up. I've never heard from the guy again. I guess he just don't want to see me, and that's cool. But this just shows that, like, you think you're going to get away with not making some amends? Universe is going to make it so that you have to. It's just the way it works, guys. You take something from the universe, it has to be returned. It's the law of karma. It's the law of what goes around comes around. I don't care what it is. You want to be successful in life and you owe a bunch of people money? You ain't going to be successful. You want to have good relationships with the opposite sex? Until you clean up the relationships with the opposite sex, you ain't going to have good relationships. You're going to continue to suffer the same chaotic stuff over and over again. You're a shitty employee or have been, you have a bunch of amends around work, guess what? You're going to struggle around work. How the universe works, guys. It's not my rules. I didn't make them up. But it has been my experience that as I clean up relationships, I have better relationships. The woman I am married to now, I had to make amends to the woman I was married to before I could enter into that relationship to karmatically balance it. Now that woman that hated me, that kicked me out, that never wanted to have anything to do with me, most people have no idea that we're divorced. In fact, the man that she is dating today, when somebody suggested that he ask her out on a date, he said, "Isn't she married?" And they said, "No, she's been divorced for like 3 years." And he's like, "Well, but I see Brandon around all the time and they seem to be okay. What's that all about?" Brandon made amends to her. And so now the relationship's been repaired and they actually raise their kids together. This stuff's magical, dudes. Magical. But, you know, don't make them if you don't want. No big deal.
All right, we're going to take a 15-minute break.